It has been a long week. We have talked about changes to Georgia's parole system, some very controversial plans to build homes on Cumberland Island, and alleged bias in the Atlanta Immigration Court. So as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think about what the heck happened this week. It is time for The Break Room.
This is more work than in my previous life. I thought it would be easier.
The expectation, luxurious accommodations. The reality, more like a disaster relief campsite.
If your baby is going to die, and it doesn't have to, it shouldn't matter how much money you make.
Joining us in The Break Room, Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, Natalie Pavelski of Cator Communications, Georgia State University Professor Eric Siegel, and Kennesaw State University Professor Roxanne Donovan. Welcome, everyone. You made it to Friday.
Good
Happy
morning.
Friday,
Good morning,
Celeste. Another week successfully finished. All right, so let's talk. We just heard the voice of Jimmy Kimmel, and so let's talk about him. The U.S. House of Representatives narrowly approved a bill to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. The Senate is next. That health care has been in the spotlight literally for quite some time. And Jimmy Kimmel shared some emotional news of his newborn son's life and death, open heart surgery.
You know, before 2014, if you were born with congenital heart disease like my son was, there was a good chance you'd never be able to get health insurance because you had a pre-existing condition. If your parents didn't have medical insurance, you might not live long enough to even get denied because of a pre-existing condition.
Kimmel then urged lawmakers to consider the consequences of what they were voting on. So, I mean, clearly the bill passed. So do appeals like this, clearly they appeal to regular people, right? Because it got shared virally millions of times. But do they appeal to politicians?
Who are not regular people.
That was a bad way for me to put that. They are regular people.
No, they're not.
I always like the way Congress passes some legislation on healthcare, but it never applies to them either. You know, that's always
they did exempt themselves.
Yeah, that's always the beautiful thing about Congress, right?
I don't know if my guess is Congress doesn't care at all about Jimmy Kimmel, but I will say this was a great public service. My daughter had meningitis when she was 2.5, and we didn't know if she was going to live or die for about 12 hours. And anyone who's been through anything like that and watched this video, it was deeply affecting, and it's a public service whether or not it affects Congress.
True that, because, I mean, my daughter was born with a birth defect. It wasn't serious, and you wouldn't even notice anything today. But the idea that maybe that we wouldn't have been able to do anything for her, just depending on how much money we made, is just repulsive. I mean, this is not Victorian England.
And studies show facts and figures don't change minds like emotional storytelling does. So it was very effective. I know I teared up when I saw the video.
This is not Victoria, England.
No, they had better manners.
Watch Victoria on PBS. In any case, all right, since we're talking about Congress, let's move just a few steps over to the White House. President Trump celebrated the passage in the House, reportedly with crates of Bud Light. I don't know if you saw those pictures of it being shipped in to the Rose Garden. But last weekend, during his 100th day in office, President Trump talked about the job of president.
I thought it would be easier. I thought it was more of I'm a details-oriented person, I think you would say that. But I do miss my old life. I like to work, so that's not a problem. But this is actually more work.
Apparently, he still wants the job. He has not resigned, but he's already running campaign commercials for 2020. I don't know if you saw the ads they released, but would you ever want to be I mean, it seems to me like I knew president was a really hard job, right?
You think?
Yeah. You should know.
And you know, if he misses his old life, I feel really sorry for him. And if he wants to go back to it tomorrow, about 100 million Americans and I would be absolutely delighted to see him do it. look at the pictures of the presidents over the years. You see him in year one and you see him in year four. Their hair is completely different. They've gone white. Duh, it's a stressful job.
Yeah.
He says he's a detailed person. Last night, he spent a lot of time with the Prime Minister of Australia. It's unclear from the videotape if he knows the Prime Minister's name. So I think him being a detailed person is yet another Trump statement that we can't really take seriously.
And it's easy to have the celebrity of his previous life and not have really the consequences that come with it. But when you're the president of the United States, the accountability is on your shoulders internationally. And the security cocoon that they wrap you in because you can't get out in public and talk to people. It's a very burdensome job, and like she said, everybody's hair turns white the first year they're in office. So,
and you start getting insulted by people you never, like Kim Jong-un of North Korea just said that he thinks Donald Trump has an elementary school education on North Korean politics. Like, I would never assume that the leader of another country was going to insult me, but if you're president,
that's what you sign up for.
Yeah.
And what you say is dissected, and I think for Trump that's been very challenging, but in his 100 days of office, he spent about 3 weeks at Mar-a-Lago. So I would say he's taking a lot of time and a lot of golf vacations to help mitigate the stress of the office.
I think elementary school education was a reach, don't you?
Uh-oh.
I remain agnostic on that. I am Sweden. But let's let's move on. In the meantime, we did get a tweet about our last subject of conversation in terms of Jimmy Kimmel's plea from Joel Cook, who tweets, I pay $12,000 per year plus the other expenses from my daughter's T1D. I'm scared to death of her having a pre-existing condition. And if you have comments on anything that you're hearing, you know how to reach us. You can tweet us like Joel did at OST Talk or call us and leave a message at 404-500-9457. Okay, so we know that beer can help spark conversations, right? Sadly, it can also derail it from time to time, depending on how much you've had. There's a new ad from Heineken that takes this idea and runs with it.
I don't believe that climate change exists. We're not taking enough action on climate change.
I think it's about time these people got off the high horse and started looking for credible problems that actually exist.
It's absolutely critical that trans people have their own voice.
That's not right. You can't, you know, you're a man, be a man, or you're a female, be a female.
Okay, so these people all end up cheering each other with their brews. So here's the issue. A lot of people say not believing in climate change isn't an opinion. That's just not believing facts or not believing that trans people should be allowed to, I guess, exist is not a belief. That's a fact that can affect other people. And if you find someone's beliefs totally offensive or outlandish, does that mean that you shouldn't sit down over a beer and have a conversation with them, or that you shouldn't want to?
Look, I think this is a big, messy country, and all of us here are used to having to work with people we disagree with, even love people we disagree with violently. I think the problem is lately, this difference between opinion and fact is really a problem. I mean, everyone is entitled to his or her own opinion. But when you make up lies and call them facts, when you say, oh, for example, that your predecessor as president wasn't born in the United States and that tens of millions of millions of Americans voted illegally on Election Day, or that climate change is a Chinese hoax, these are demonstrably false things. And I think we are blending that line between facts and opinions.
This is tough, though, because the New York Times this week published an editorial by someone denying climate change.
Yeah.
And then apparently many, many, many liberals and progressives canceled their subscription.
Yeah.
That's wrong. I mean, there's something about that is very disheartening.
And also,
we're not talking to each other anymore.
You don't have to answer every perceived slight with a sledgehammer necessarily. There are times when someone says something offensive and may not even realize it. And sometimes you do have to give people the benefit of the doubt.
But here's my thing. Even if I meet somebody that says that climate change is a Chinese hoax, that doesn't mean I can't talk to them, or should I?
I think it depends. Having a conversation is really important. We can't just ignore people who have views that are not based in fact. But sometimes those conversations can be an assault on your personhood. So what the person is believing is at the center of your identity. So sitting and having that conversation is a real price that the minoritized body is feeling. And so are you ready to have that conversation, and can you handle the emotional strife and stress that it might
take? Can you give me specific examples of what you're talking about? Like, what's a conversation that you would not entertain the other
It's
persons.
Not that I wouldn't. I'd have to be in the place to do so. So if someone denies that racism exists, as a woman of color, they're denying my existence, or saying I believe in colorblindness and everyone should, then it's going to be really hard for me to have that conversation because it's an assault on my personhood. So would I do it? It depends. Do I have the emotional bandwidth to do it and sit there without, at the end of the day, being so wrung out that I can't go and have a conversation with someone that I care about? I may decide I'm going to intentionally boundary that conversation.
And a lot depends on their intention as well, right? Is somebody trying to troll you, trying to make you feel like less of a person, trying to get under your skin? Or are they genuinely coming from a place where, you know, they maybe haven't experienced diversity? They just genuinely don't get it.
Yeah. And today, too, though, we live in the world of oversimplification of arguments. So we like to have our one-liners, and we throw our one-liners out, and this is the way it should be. And if you don't agree with this, I'm going to cut you off. And I just had somebody do that to me on Facebook the other day when I just listed a comment about something that they were talking about, a piece of legislation. Didn't agree with me. You're out. You're off the page. And if when you live in that kind of world, I mean, you know, you're going to have a lot of adversity, a
but
lot of controversy.
Social media is not conversation. And let me just say this as a public service. Conversation over Facebook is not actual conversation. Well,
and we should distinguish between us having conversations with each other or even on radio or on Facebook or Twitter with government officials using false facts to justify policy. And that's where our culture is heading if we're not already there. And that's a much more serious conversation.
But it's not a bad thing either to question and be skeptical of certain things. And I think, you know, I see this in science a lot now where they say the science, it's definitive. You cannot question the science. No, that's what science is all about.
Yeah, but the overall, if you're talking about climate change, the overall, you know, humans are changing the climate. There is no doubt about that. Now, how much, how fast, what we do about it, the politics, the economics, the social ramifications, sure, that's fair ground.
But I can question the composition of your model. Are the variables correct? Are your assumptions in the model right?
That's not what they're doing. They're questioning the need for regulation.
But I'm just saying, you can't even do that.
I hate to cut off this very civil and smart conversation because it's what we're talking about. But let's just take a moment. It's Friday. We're hanging out in the break room. And my guests are Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, Kennesaw State University Professor Roxanne Donovan, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, and Georgia State University Professor Eric Siegel. And we want to say a special thank you to Savannah Coffee Roasters. They donate the coffee that we drink, and you can find them online at savannahcoffee.com. All right. There are a lot of festivals in Georgia, and you're going to be able to enjoy a number of music festivals in the coming months.
Hey, bud. Let's party. Me and Mick are going to wing on over to London and jam with the Stones.
In fact, next week we preview artists from Atlanta's Shaky Knees Festival, which is coming up. But I bet there's one festival at least that you might be grateful you missed. Fire Festival in the Bahamas. It was promoted as 2 weeks of, quote, culinary delights and luxury. That turned out to be mud, empty tents mostly, artists that didn't show up, and cheese sandwiches. At the last minute, organizers called it off, but not until people were already stuck on the island. Many people were stranded. There's now a class action lawsuit against the festival organizers. They want their money back, but they also want damages. And my question isn't, should they have their money refunded? They should. But do they deserve damages from the organizers?
I think this is negligence, absolute negligence. Mm-hmm. You've got a partially inhabited island with no infrastructure and no way to have food services, and you're making these promises to these people, charging some of them upwards of $3,000 a piece. I mean, that's ridiculous.
And then they told people not to bring cash, so they couldn't even get off the island if they want. So they knowingly deceived the public, kept them trapped. Oh, yeah, they need to pay damages for
sure. But $100 million, does that seem high, or is that just because they have to pay the lawyers?
Probably. Eric?
Is there a lawyer in the group? I think, I'm not a torts lawyer, but I think these people should obviously be made whole. We all agree on that.
Yes.
I'm tired, and I teach lawyers, I am really tired of this idea that when something bad happens to you, you should be made more than whole. That's a significant problem in our culture. Other countries don't share it. These people should be made whole. They shouldn't get a windfall.
Meaning they shouldn't get damages.
Meaning they shouldn't get a windfall. I mean, damages are hard. Sometimes, I mean, if someone sacrificed a day of work that was important to them, that caused them additional pecuniary loss, we can talk about that. But this idea of kind of like emotional pain and all that stuff, that's a uniquely American idea, and I have qualms about it.
Well, this is something that many of you might want to weigh in on, and you know how to reach us, 404-500-9457, or tweet us at OST Talk. All right, speaking of tickets and money, a new study reveals exactly why traffic tickets are so expensive in Georgia.
Here goes. I sped. I followed too closely. I ran a stop sign. I almost hit a Chevy. I sped some more. I failed to yield at a crosswalk. I changed lanes in the intersection. I changed lanes without signaling while running a red light and speeding.
Is that all?
No.
I have unpaid parking tickets.
All right. According to a report from the Laura and John Arnold Foundation, judges in Georgia have to add a whole slew of surcharges onto tickets. A person pulled over with a suspended license, for example, will likely face surcharges of more than $400. That's in addition to the ticket, which could be over $1,000. Lane changing in Gwinnett County can cost you $175 in surcharges and fees. How do we feel about this?
You know, so a few years, different topic but related, real quick. A few years ago, I was lobbying for a Georgia endangerment statute for kids, and 49 states had it. 49 out of 50. We were the only one. And when I went to the Capitol to talk about it, I got the same answer. I would say, okay, we disagree, but 49 of 50 states agree with us. It feels like Georgia's always different. Why are we always different? And if other states don't do this, why isn't that the answer?
For me, it's unjust because it disproportionately impacts economically vulnerable people who make a mistake and have to pay a misdemeanor. So if you're wealthy and you have to pay $1,000, that's not as impactful.
Right, it's not a punishment.
Right, it's not that much of a punishment at all.
The point I was making is that when we do things differently, we never really examine it, and we should.
I can tell you, as someone who does the budget for a judicial circuit, it's state unfunded mandates. The state says you are now going to do this with your jail system, your judicial system, or whatever, and they don't fund it. And they put these mandates on us.
Well, they don't fund it because they don't want to pass any taxes.
Well,
exactly.
Absolutely.
So
but then they put it on the local jurisdictions. And then what they do is they give you a mechanism, so to speak, and that's these fees that you can add on. But I will tell you, in Fayette County, we use our fees for inmate meals and victim assistance. That's what the fees go to locally. Now, there's a hefty portion that goes to the state, and God knows where that goes. It goes into the ether somewhere and dissolves in the budget. But that's what it is. The state mandates something, and you have to have a way to pay for it.
Is it so bad if the legislature's purpose is to keep tax? They're keeping taxes low.
Oh, no, they're just hiding what things really cost. I mean, I can see 10 to 15% or something like Steve mentioned, where you're paying for victim assistance or something that has to do with the criminal justice system. But that one judge said that the surcharges can add 40 to 45% or even exceed the cost of the ticket.
It can double, yeah.
This is legislators being too chicken to raise taxes when they have to.
And there should be transparency. Like, we can argue, none of us know enough about the facts to know if these fees are really needed, but there should be total transparency about it.
One of the largest problems with the legislature is, and this is beyond these tickets, it's a lot of fees. If you buy a new set of tires, they charge you a dumping fee. There's several fees. And they always plunder these funds. It never goes to the intended purpose. You're lucky if 50% of the money at the state level goes to the intended purpose.
So it just ends up in a general slush fund?
Yeah, it goes into the general fund and spent elsewhere.
Not 100% of them, but many.
Yeah.
All right. So let's move on. Talking about, again, money and where it's going. Georgia Senator David Perdue wants to make it illegal to sell a Purple Heart medal. He says these military awards are often lost or they're stolen, and then they end up getting sold by secondhand dealers. So should it be illegal to sell a medal that you've received from the U.S. government?
I don't even know. Like, where is he getting his data from? What? There's absolutely no evidence to suggest the overwhelming majority of Purple Hearts are lost or stolen. But to the question whether or not you can sell a government medal, yes, if you want to sell it and it's yours, go ahead and sell it. You earned it serving your country.
Wait, so do you have to? We have to verify that it's yours?
Frankly, have a whole market. If there's a market out there for it, good luck.
You
sell it, get some money. Oh my God, no. Take that back.
I know, that was my point. Listen, if you earn a Purple Heart, do with it whatever you want to do with it.
Right. Now, I was trying to think about this because, you know, my a couple years ago, we got to go to Arlington National Cemetery for a really late, decades late service for my Uncle Sonny, who died as a young Marine sergeant in Korea. And I was trying to think, if my cousin decided to sell my uncle's Purple Heart, what would I think? And would I like to see it? No. But you can buy replicas on Amazon for $30. I mean, I don't see how you regulate this. I think my bigger question is, if what Senator Perdue wants to do here is honor men and women who have been injured in the service of the country, I guess I'd rather see him focus on something like Iraq and Afghanistan veterans being denied benefits at a higher rate than
veterans' mental health services.
Yeah, 20 veterans killing themselves every day, according to the VA. I just think there's more important things here. It's not that I'm necessarily against this. I just question the focus.
But there was a huge outcry when some people have given their medals to someone, like, for example, when they've given their medals to someone who never served, right?
Well, and you had that recent case here in Georgia where the guy put it on his application, his job application,
exactly,
that he was awarded this medal. Now, in that instance, if you're falsifying your employment application, yes, you should feel the heat.
Okay, so let me sift through this. In other words, it should be legal to sell the medal, but not legal. You should be prosecuted if you pretend.
Well, the Supreme Court had a case on this. I mean,
yes,
Lying to secure a benefit should not be protected by the First Amendment.
Right, I agree.
What he said.
All right. If we are hanging out in the break room, with us is, you just heard the voice of Georgia State University Professor Eric Siegel. We also have with us Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, and Kennesaw State University Professor Roxanne Donovan. Let's move on to something infinitely more complicated. A recent Reuters poll finds most Americans believe that race relations are getting worse. Over 50% believe that. And a third of them say racism and bigotry in America is a, quote, imminent threat to the country. Imminent threat. So do we agree with this?
Here's the thing. I do teach this for a living. In 1787, the biggest issue in this country was racism. In 1868, the biggest issue in this country was racism. In the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, the biggest issue in this country is racism. It is still the biggest issue in this country. And until we totally own this problem, we will never go down the road of improving it to a significant degree.
But I see it as more of a corrosive, long-term threat than something that's going to, torpedo
imminent
the
threat.
Yeah, I don't. Imminent seems the wrong word to me. It's a corrosive, serious, long-term. It's like rot in the foundation of your house,
that's what I'm saying,
rather than a tree falling on your house.
But that's not. This is most people saying it's getting worse.
Yeah, actually, there's data to back them up too.
If you look at the police shootings and the fact that now you can capture these things on video and there's definitive proof of what has happened, that I think elevates the anger in the community. But I think you also can have some groups that want to use some of that on both sides of the spectrum, and they're elevating that to push an agenda, perhaps. I mean, when the Secretary of Education gets criticized when the University of Bethune-Cookman gets criticized for allowing the Secretary of Education to give the graduation speech, and they're talking about, her positions on race and whatnot, I think you're kind of going over the edge.
But we've seen, for example, in 2016, the Anti-Defamation League said that hate incidents targeting Jews increased by 33% last year. And there's been anti-Muslim, there's been racism.
Yeah, okay, but we have to be careful. I'm sorry to interrupt. We have to be careful about that. There is no, you should talk, but there is no question.
Yeah, we should hear from the one woman of color in the room, right?
There is no question that those incidents happen and they're getting worse. But that is not America's soul-searing problem. America's soul-searing problem is race in terms of African Americans. That's our problem.
I would argue that it's race among people of color in general.
Yeah.
And I think what's really challenging at this moment is there are laws that are disenfranchised, or executive action that are disenfranchising Muslim groups or disenfranchising minoritized bodies. But is it an imminent threat? Well, it depends. Are you the person who is now fearful to call the police? I would say that is a threat. Are you feeling threatened by the state and by white supremacist organizations as a person of color, for example? I would say yes, that is an imminent threat to your sense of self, to your personhood, to feeling safe in the U.S. And there have been lots of evidence to suggest, at least from urban areas, that there's a rise in hate crimes. The Southern Poverty Law Center also reports a rise in hate groups. And so we're in a particular moment that is about the undercurrent of racism, xenophobia, all sexism, misogyny in our society. But I think we're spiking in how individuals are acting with each other and how groups are acting against individuals.
And people feel they have the right to speak in ugly ways that a few years ago maybe they wouldn't have.
Before Trump, though, a book was written called The New Jim Crow, which has nothing to do with Trump or any of the new stuff or anything to do with Muslims, that basically statistically shows that what we used to separate whites and blacks in schools and other places. Now we put young black men in jail. And this, I would recommend this book to everybody. I didn't write it, but I'd recommend this book, The New Jim Crow. And it really details how racism.
Yeah, it's written by Michelle Alexander, yeah. And that was, I think it was published maybe in 2010. It's been a few years, but it is a great book.
And you bring a good point to the structure and the systems that increase the likelihood that people of color and black men, to the point that you're making, are less likely to succeed, while individuals who, particularly middle-class individuals who are white, are more likely to succeed. There's definitely a lot of evidence about that. So there's systems, there's structures, there's individuals, and then there's this moment that seems to amplify all the issues.
So we're going to move on to something a little less serious to before we let people go for their weekend. So Einstein was right yet again. There is now a mathematical model that shows time travel is at least mathematically possible. It couples Einstein's theory of relativity and the possibility that time is not a separate dimension. And so as an equation anyway, it's possible. But here's the question.
So all of time and space, everything that ever happened or ever will, where do you want to start?
Doctor Who. Okay, so here we go. If you were going to travel through time, where what time would you go? This is a very different question, I should mention, for someone of color. You're much more limited.
Or for a woman.
Where you can travel.
Well, yeah. I could tell you where I would go, and I would get the adulation of every metropolitan Atlantan. I would go down to the portion of the federal highway system where the gentleman comes down to Georgia and says, hey, if we merge 85 and 75 together, that would be a fantastic idea. I would kill that person. I would assassinate them, and there would be statues honoring me everywhere in metropolitan Atlanta.
Fair enough.
I'm feeling much less altruistic. I'd hop back to the 80s, buy stock in Microsoft and Apple.
Oh, you would be a capitalist.
I'm afraid I would be.
Eric?
I would what he said.
That's too easy.
As a woman of color, I'm not going back. I don't want to know the future. I'm about being mindful in the moment. Thank you very much.
Yeah, it's way more limited. You don't want to go all that much further back in time. All right, we're going to do a lightning round here. But of course, to all those listening, you know how you can get your answers to us. 404-500-9457. Post on Facebook or on Twitter. All right, not to rain on Georgia's parade, but the website Wallet Hub finds Georgia is one of the nation's 10 least fun states. That's based on entertainment, recreation, nightlife, etc. In the minute we have left, what state is, forget Georgia for a minute, you don't have to defend her, but what state is the most fun?
Vegas, baby.
Oh, okay, God, Nevada. No.
Natalie?
For outdoors, Utah.
Utah, okay.
And I love New York for New York City.
I'm a New York City gal. I'm New York City all the way.
Okay, two votes for New York City, one for Vegas.
New York City.
And one for Utah.
What about you, Celeste? You didn't answer?
I didn't even think about it. Detroit. For sure.
Wow.
Okay, we're out of time.
Unexpected.
In the break room today, and there's silence in the room. But I stand by. Look,
if you say so.
If you want to spend the next minute me telling you how awesome Plot Detroit shift. Is, I will.
This show has been brought to you by Detroit.
Detroit. Detroit is awesome.
It okay. is awesome. I agree with you, Celeste.
Vegas, baby.
If any of you out there listening want to back me up here, let's show some Detroit love because the Motor City is awesome. Okay, we're out of time in the break room today. Eric, thanks to my guests. Edward Austin Hall, by the way, says I'd travel to any past in which I could watch a healthy Charles Mingus perform live. Nice one. Okay, thanks to Steve Brown of the Fayette County Board of Commissioners, Natalie Pavelski of Cater Communications, Georgia State University Professor Eric Siegel, and Kennesaw State University Professor Roxanne Donovan. But again, we want to hear from you. What would be the most fun state? What is the most fun state in the Union? Tweet us at OST Talk or post on Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great weekend.